Hello, everybody, and welcome to another course for this morning. So my name is Eddie. I'm one of the tutors here, and we're going through this module called How to Meditate. So let's begin by, first of all, getting comfortable in the seat you're in. So make sure that your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed. And then imagine that the spiritual lineage of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are appearing in front of you at the level of your eyebrows. And you're sitting in the center of the great crowd of every sentient being. So to purify your motivation for being in the company of the Buddhas and representing all sentient beings, please engage in the 9-round breathing meditation, whereby you begin by breathing in the white light in through your left nostril, and then breathing out black light through the right nostril for 3 breaths, and then reversing the process. So 3 breaths, breathing in white light, breathing out black light through the right nostril, then breathing in white light through the right and breathing black through the left. So I'll begin now. Switch over. And now breathing in through white light into both nostrils and exhaling the black light of confusion and ignorance and misunderstandings, with black light through the 2 nostrils. So now with your motivations purified, recollect that everyone equally wishes to avoid suffering, equally wishes to have happiness, and equally lacks genuine happiness. Furthermore, we are all equal in that for everyone, the causes of suffering can be eliminated, and the potential for complete, genuine happiness, which abides within us, can be actualized. So decide to do this for your own sake and for the sake of others. Achieving complete, genuine happiness, enlightenment itself, freeing yourself from suffering, fulfilling your deepest wishes and desires, and having the power to help others. So now imagine a small figure of light leaves from the heart of Shakyamuni Buddha who's in front of you, leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head. This emanation of the Buddha, which is in essence your own teacher, descends through space, entering the crown of your head, goes down to the level of your heart, and then begins to expand, filling your chest, and your arms, your lower limbs, your throat and head with light. And this light continues to expand, moving out through the pores of your skin, spreading out into the 10 directions of space. And within that space, wherever there are sentient beings, think that they are illuminated by that light and transformed into becoming fully awakened beings. And the light increases, filling all of space, and the barriers between the self and the world have vanished completely. And from the furthest directions of space, the light begins to retreat. It draws back into your heart. So recognize that this is the deepest nature of your own mind. This nature is the potential to fully awaken. It abides within you without edge, without circumference, without center. And though you feel it embodied, sitting on the seat, breathing normally and naturally, you recognize that you have the potential to put an end to your own suffering and to deliver all other living beings from suffering and its causes also. And you and I, we can all do that by relying upon the person who done it themselves, the Buddha, and the spiritual community, our teachers in the Sangha, and the teachings themselves, the Dharma. So let's now take refuge and generate a mind of enlightenment to bring about our welfare and the welfare of every other living being. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Highest Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, to stabilize and enhance the wish for enlightenment, we'll recite the four immeasurables together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, the essence of the path is to abandon whatever hinders us and accumulate all the merit necessary to advance on that path. In the accumulation of virtue and the abandonment of non-virtue, these are all summed up in stages of progress which are within the seven-limb prayer. So let's recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. They come to make an offering to the Buddha, and this is the offering of the mandala. Its essence is just the letting go of grasping and clinging to our body, our mind, our sense of self in the world. So, in the absence of clinging, think that your body transforms into a pure land where all beings can abide and take the teachings of the Buddha. A short mandala. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offered. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamnariyatayami. So we've released the offering. It's been accepted by the Buddha. He smiles at us in delight. And through our recognition of that smile, our acceptance of that smile, our mind is transformed and made soft and open to the teachings and their meanings. Okay, so if your eyes are closed or open, just bring your attention back to the screen now and we'll begin the class. So we've come to, this is class 8 in this course, How to Meditate, and it's the last class. And we've covered these topics. We looked at the purpose and function of meditation, postures we need to take, looked at different breath meditations, we engage in some visualization meditations, we looked at the obstacles we might face and their removal. And then we looked at the leisure and opportunities we have as fortunate human beings. Then we looked at equanimity. And finally, throughout the course, we've been dedicating our virtue to our enlightenment and the enlightenment of every other living being. And dedicating virtue is an antidote to wrong views and ensures that the energy of our sessions is not lost, and that that it continues to increase and expand, bringing all the positive results we need to achieve enlightenment. And these are some of the books that I've been using throughout the course. And today, especially, I've used this new book called In Praise of Great Compassion. So this only came into our shop a couple of days ago. I bought it previously from Amazon though. And really this is the very best book that I've come across at the moment for readings on the four immeasurables, the cultivation of bodhicitta, different forms of love. And it's, you know, they're presented from the point of view of the Chinese Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and Pali Buddhism. Very easy to read and to understand. Now, before that, the other book I really relied on was this black one down the middle called Buddhism, that one teacher, many traditions. And that also has a great deal of really good information in it. Widening the Circle of Love is a fantastic little book because it's got all these meditations within it. And the other books are just really good complementary material that I've been using all the time. Now today we're going to look at brief loving kindness. And loving kindness that's within the seven cores and effect personal instructions in the lineage descended from the great elder Atisha. Was a preliminary to that, we're going to look also at romantic love. And this is where I found some very good material in this that new book I was talking about, you know, The Great Compassion by the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron. And we can also look at some other forms of love that are included within the sort of foundations that are used to build up loving kindness. So let's begin with the first, romantic love, which is also known as sensual love. Sensual love, which is actually selfish, affectionate desire. So this really sort of hit me in the nose. And I really liked it because I thought, oh, this is, there's an acronym here, it's SAD. So we often think it's really a joyous thing, isn't it, to be romantically involved. But actually, the romantic love is really, from a Buddhist perspective, just the suffering of change. So it's a means of sort of relieving us from our immediate sufferings, but it changes. So many movies and novels and other art forms deal with romantic and sensual love. So I think this is one we're most familiar with. But from a Buddhist viewpoint, this emotion should more accurately be called attachment, because it's generally based on exaggerating someone's good qualities or projecting excellent qualities that aren't actually there. So attachment will give way to emotional neediness and possessiveness, and which leads to making demands or having high expectations of the other person. But so I think, you know, we're all familiar with this.
Eddie, it's kind of interesting too that the actual word romantic comes from, you know, the romance, the incredible poetry that was composed kind of as an ode to your muse, and it was actually, I mean, in the beginning it was understood to be a complete projection, and then something must have happened where it became like inherently existent, and you actually then entered into like a sensual relationship instead of it being kind of like this muse.
Yeah, that's true with me. Yeah, it's very interesting to read the history of love, because that's one of the things you'll find out. And reading that history, you'll find that, yeah, this word love and its meaning is dependent. That's what really comes across. And being something dependent, it changes. So its meanings have changed throughout the centuries. And of course, you know, you read, you'll find in the Greek presentation of love, they have a number of different forms of love. Even in the Christian tradition, there are different forms of love, because, you know, Christianity sort of came out of the Greek. But for most of us nowadays, it's this romantic love and lust seem to be pushed together. And really, when you investigate your own feelings about this, you'll find it's really about yourself and having something, having affection for the object and a desire to possess it. So when I'm coming, I just come across this term in that book, selfish affectionate desire, and that really struck me. So I want to put that up there. I think, just have a look back over your life and think of all the romantic involvements you've got involved in, and see if it was really ever about the other person. Most times we just see somebody, we are attracted immediately, and it becomes about me. Me, I want. And so we have to respect desire, but there's also, like I said, this affection in it. So now this is the type of love that we're not trying to develop in our Buddhist training. In fact, immeasurable love is actually free from the complications of selfishness and this desirous attachment. But how do we actually develop a love that's like that, free from selfishness, free from attachment? So Lama Tsongkhapa said, from the outset, establish an even-minded attitude, eliminating the bias which comes from attachment to some living beings and hostility to others. Otherwise, any love or compassion you feel will be biased. You will never feel unbiased affectionate love or compassion. So cultivate impartiality. So this term, he's using impartiality here. We also know that word to be equanimity. So it's got many different connotations. And here we're using it to mean a state of mind that is free from the disturbing emotions of biased attraction, repulsion, and indifference. Because these are all based on a sense of naivety. Being unaware of the possibility that these persons who we could actually be friends. So when we cultivate equanimity, the result of it is to have a mind that's sort of even, meaning the, for as an analogy, for instance, if you go to paint a house, what you normally have to do is you've got to scrape off the old paint and you bring it down to the wood and everything has to be like even. And then you put the new paint on and it all sticks and it all looks lovely. But if you don't do that, it really turns out to be quite a messy affair. The other analogy they often use is the analogy of making a garden for yourself. So the first thing you've got to do when you do that is have a look at the ground. You've got to turn into a garden and take out all the rocks and stones and roots and rubbish. So the ground becomes nice and smooth and you can work with it. It's the same here. If you really wish to develop this unbiased love, this called loving kindness, we have to sort of prevent the bias from desirous attachment, hatred, and indifference from arising. So the mind is sort of open for this development. So when the mind is open, it doesn't mean that we're no longer able to have any feelings. It doesn't mean that we don't have any positive feelings towards others and we just become like a sort of emotionless robot. The analogy is that, if we've cleared the plain of the rocks, or if we've cleared the wood of the blisters of old paint and so forth, then we've got a really smooth surface upon which to build something good. Now, like from this slide on, we're really going to be now talking about the love and kindness, in this term love, from a Buddhist perspective. And there are different forms of love within the Buddhist presentation too. So I want to bring to your attention three of them, and we'll talk about these and show how they really relate to the practice called love and kindness, or the effect called love and kindness. The first some forms of love. So these are the three that are found in the Buddhist literature. The first is called affectionate love, the second, cherishing love, and the third, wishing love. These are the three types of love. Now, affectionate love is a mind unmixed with desirous attachment, which sees another person as pleasant, likable, or beautiful. Can use the example of a mother and her children. So when a mother looks at her children, she feels great affection for them and perceives them to be beautiful, no matter how they appear to other people. And because she feels this affectionate love, well, she naturally feels them to be precious and important. And this is the cherishing love, precious and important. Now, because she cherishes her children, she sincerely wishes them to be happy. And this wish for them to be happy is called wishing love. So wishing love arises from cherishing love, which in turn arises from affectionate love. And we have to sort of develop these three types of love towards all living beings, and without affection, without exception, to arrive at the state of loving kindness. So do you have any questions about this? Do you find this interesting?
There's no questions yet. I'm just wondering how come it has to go in that order. Does it have to go in that order?
Yeah, that is the order it actually goes in.
So how come wishing love can't, say, for instance, start it off?
Well, you need to have some. Why would you be wishing them to be happy?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you can see you need some sort of basis for that, don't you? In fact, I remember Rishi Tashi Searing often talk about, you know, we need to feel warm towards others. And this is this affectionate love, this warmth. You find them really, you're pleased to be in their company. They please you, they appear beautiful and good to you. So that's where it begins. It's like, you know, we call this, is called like the affectionate love.
So does that mean that if you don't have overt affection, then you can't have the other two?
Yep, that's right. You might say you've got the other two, but they're not stable. They'll change. But like you're saying, see, we've got to remember here that underneath this, we've put in place equanimity.
So this is really affectionate love from a Buddhist sense, not
That's
from
right.
a modern
area. Right. Yep. And yep. they've used this analogy of how a mother relates to her child to show you how it sort of works and then how it's developed. Because remember when later on we come to develop love and kindness, we're going to be looking at, you know, all living beings have been our parents and they've cared for us and so forth. And so we've got this sort of thing where sometimes we look at all beings, we've had all sorts of relationships with them and we develop this affection for them and then cherish them. And then we finally, you know, wish them to be happy.
So is this affection then quite different from just an emotional feeling?
It's got the emotional feeling, but it's more than that. And same with the cherishing love. There's got to be the feeling of cherishing them that's in there. And also the feeling of when you wish something for someone or for yourself. Okay, we'll go on to the next slide.
Yep.
So I wanted to bring your attention to these three forms of love, because they're very rarely discussed in terms of a process like this. And often you don't get, it's just, you know, just called love, loving kindness or something, but actually this term called loving kindness has come about in defense of a whole lot of other things that have gone before it. And these are some of the other things. So when we come to cultivate loving kindness, there are ways of doing it. One way is within what they call the six causes and one result method. The other is within the method called exchanging self and others. There are also techniques that you can do within the Chinese tradition, and there's other techniques you can do within the Pali tradition. So many, there are many techniques. And what was really fantastic about that new book was that those techniques are in there. But we're going to look at it from the perspective of cultivating loving kindness through the lens of the six causes and one effect. So there's just these four steps in it, and these are these. So remember, before we can actually cultivate actual loving kindness, we've got to already have put in place equanimity and have been able to dampen biased attachment, biased aversion, and biased indifference. So the mind is now sort of open, and we're going to build on that mind, this mind of equanimity. The equanimity is really balancing our social reactivity. So social reactivity meaning desirous attachment towards friends and those we dislike the appearance of. Anger, aversion, hatred towards those who threaten our happiness, and indifference towards those we just don't care about. So that's what the equanimity is doing, balancing the social reactivity and removing the bias. Now we're going to build on it on these four steps. And the first is recognizing beings as having been our mothers. Now, why do that? To inspire a sense of commonality and solidarity with everyone. The second step, recalling their kindness. This is going to inspire commonality to inspire gratitude arising from this commonality and solidarity. So the first step, inspiring commonality and solidarity, recalling their kindness, inspiring gratitude. Resolving to repay their kindness, sort of inspiring reciprocity of affection. Now, so others have been kind to us, others have extended affection to us. We recognize it, we want to repay it. And finally, we have this loving kindness. And this is inspiring within us the recognition of the value of others being happy. So within the technique called the six causes and one effect method, these four steps form the basis for great compassion. So they're preliminaries to great compassion. What they produce, you know, in their preliminary form is great loving kindness.
And Eddie, can you just clarify for me, how does this fit in with that, the previous slide, you know, of the affection and the cherishing?
Well, it runs through these steps here.
So this is then how we generate those three kind of levels.
Now, those three other levels of support or this play their part within each of these four steps.
Okay.
So now I just want to take now we've got to look at this presentation. And what I'll need to do here is just take a step back to have a to look at this equanimity. Oh, sorry, the yes, it is. It's a my mistake. Sorry, we've got to look at this recognizing beings as having been our mothers. So, a quote first of all by Lama Tsongkhapa. Says, because cyclic existence is beginningless, or without a findable beginning, your births are also without beginning. Therefore, you have died and been reborn time and time again. There is absolutely no kind of body which you have not assumed in cyclic existence. There is absolutely no place where you have not been born. And there is no person who has not been a relative such as your mother. Now, this quote by so Lama Tsongkhapa said this. So there's a quote by a Sangha from his Levels of Yogic Deeds, which is stated to support this explanation here that Lama Tsongkhapa said. So a Sangha said, you know, I have difficulty seeing any person in the distant past who has not been your father, mother, uncle, aunt, sister, master, abbot, guru, or someone like a guru. Now, so here, obviously, we're talking about rebirth. A rebirth is a cornerstone for a large and crucial portion of the Dharma teaching. Now, Kensa Rinpoche said, if you can conclude that past and future lives do indeed exist, then you don't need reasons to support the idea that all sentient beings have been your mother. However, if you are not able to conclude that past and future lives do exist, then reasoning can help you. So we'll look at some of these reasons. That there's this type of reasoning, which I'll show you very shortly, which may or may not make a great deal of sense to you. So you probably have to look at the slide often and sort of think about it, try and think about what they're saying. And you'll also need to remember how a sentient being exists. Because if you get that wrong, then the whole thing won't stand up. And that's because the basis for your reasoning will be mistaken. So let's have a look at the slide for reasoning demonstrating past lives and rebirths. So here's the first part of it. If one being has been our mother within this lifetime, then everybody has been our mother at some time or another, because everybody is equal. Now, then the second part comes up, which says, if that were not the case, then if one sentient being was never our mother, then no sentient being was ever our mother, because everybody is equal. So the really things you've got to get your head around is everybody being equal, like how? Who is the sentient being, everybody? And how can it be that they are equal? That's what we've got to sort of find out.
Yeah, Eddie, because these two quotes, I get the quotes up until the bit where it says, because everybody is equal, and then I don't even get the reasoning anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It just comes in and slips out all the time, isn't it? So this was great because this was a reasoning worked out by Western students taught by Alexander Berzin. And he thought it was a good reasoning. So this is what they call middle way reasoning, Prasangika reasoning. So Prasangika reasoning brings about absurd consequences, absurd conclusions. And that's why it sort of throws you off. So he said, this is a perfect prasangika proof using an absurd conclusion. So the second part is the conclusion. But it is absurd, isn't it? If you think about it, he said, if this were not the case, the first part, were not the case, then if one sentient being was never our mother, and you're going to go, hang on a minute, I've got a mother, or I had a mother. So, you know. So you can, this whole thing could only, if I've never had a mother, then past and future lives don't exist. So, just a little about this slide, right? So, given that the premise here is beginningless time, finite number of sentient beings and everybody being equal, then we have to prove that everybody has been a mother. So these are the three things, right? Beginningless time, a finite number of sentient beings, and everybody being equal. So like I said, you've got to look at, well, how are we all equal? That's what I'm saying. Who is the, this we've got to find out, all sentient beings and their quality. Then they put up the reasoning. So Berzin took this reasoning off to Toronto and presented it to a Tibetan Geshe, who was one of the teachers at the debating school in Dharamsala. And he showed him the proof, and the teacher was very pleased. He said, yep, this is a very, very good proof. And so this is the only proof I've ever come across in all my reading to prove, you know, past lives and rebirths. Now, I'll give you a clue about the equality of all sentient beings. They all exist in mere name. This is where we're equal. We are all equal in that we exist in mere name. So if you take that and you work your way backwards, you'll see how this thing hangs together. Otherwise, however, you'll find it's quite difficult, because what you always end up doing, well, I did for quite some time, and just sort of shake your head. You'll find that what you normally do is equate the word mother with the body of a person as a mother. That's one of the blocking points for us. It's like equating the body with the person. Anyway, people aren't their bodies, so you've got to remember that. So anyway, we've got to, this is this what we need to do before we can actually, you know, use reasoning to bring about this understanding.
So Eddie, I still can't quite get the link. But why it's a proof, I don't get the because part. So I can get the first part, I can get what you're saying about the equality being our kind of mode of existence, how we in mere name, but I don't get why is that a because.
So the because comes in after here, because everybody, you know, not because everybody is equal. Is that the part you don't get?
Yep.
So you exist in mere name, I exist in mere name, Debbie exists in mere name, Sue exists in mere name, Martin exists in mere name.
Yeah, I get
they're all equal.
But I don't get why that proves that therefore you've all been my mother.
Because mothers exist in mere name. In fact, everything exists in mere name. So this is what they call the great equality. And then the rest follows, right? So we've got to have an understanding of past lives and so forth before we can, you know, get into this idea of recognizing our mothers, and this is a type of reasoning. So, of course, I doubt any of you are going to go, oh, of course, because I certainly didn't. Anyway, let's have a look at this first step, recognizing your mothers. So this is reasoning. And the point of it to do it is to do this, inspire commonality and solidarity. So all beings have not only previously been your mothers, but will also be your mothers in the future, a limitless number of times. So Lama Tsongkhapa says, reflect upon this and become convinced that all beings have been your mothers. Once you develop this conviction, you'll then easily remember their kindness and so forth. But if you do not develop it, you will have no basis for remembering their kindness. And this is, you know, there's a few steps that are really hard to get your head around in the Lam Rim. This is one of them, one of the most difficult points to get your head around. So if you, you know, immediately, you don't get it immediately, well, don't be surprised. So basically, we're attempting to develop a recognition that there's no sentient being who has never been our mother as a method to establish a sense of closeness with everyone. It'd be very difficult to try and cultivate a close relationship with everyone on a physical or verbal level. But that's not what's being asked of us. We're talking about developing a mental attitude that we're close to all sentient beings.
Eddie, so there's a couple of questions here. So Pauline's asking, is it that we exist in mere name, however we all individually exist?
Yep, that's right.
And then Martin's asking, is it because we all come from a single source?
What's the single source, Martin?
And then also, as a bit of a sideline, Maria's asking, why is there a finite number of sentient beings? So Martin, a single source, Martin's saying a single cell, so he's kind of referring to the physical.
Yeah, that's mistaken again. No.
So when you're saying coming from a single cell, that's the physical component.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're not the physical component. That's what I'm saying. You know, we're not the physical component. We are, persons are not bodies. Persons are not physical components.
And I suppose it's kind of an interesting parallel too, because it's not that at one time in the universe, there was only one cell. There is also like a finite amount of energy in all various different forms that then transformed into a cell, but it didn't kind of, you know, grow from one thing to many, just like with the sentient beings, it didn't grow from one sentient being to many. It's been.
So this is the, you know, so when we come with thinking like that, one of the things that hopefully you'll recognize over time is that when you think like that, what you're coming at is one cause, singular cause. So there isn't anything that's ever come into existence from one cause. So that's something to remember, because having that idea is the same thing. That, you know, that's the idea of karma, right? So you know, so we can put that forward like Martin has suggested here. We're looking at the singular, the first cause of something physical. So that there is no first cause. Like why? You'd go, then it's like, you know, there is a first cause if you believe in God, there's your first cause. But if you don't believe in God, then you can't have a first cause for something. It's like, what came before that? You know, you can't just have something from nothing. something doesn't arise from absolutely nothing. A first cause doesn't come from absolutely nothing before it. You know, then you can say, well, if it were the case, then anything could arise from anywhere, at any time, from anything. So that idea, we've got to sort of catch ourselves thinking like that and go, no, that don't work.
Okay.
Now, somebody asked, you said, was it Maria who asked the question?
About why is there a finite number of
seconds? Oh, yeah, this is right. So, you need to think, sort of think about this too. It's a good question. What produces sentient beings? Well, you know, like I said, what is a sentient being, first of all?
Well, a consciousness.
Okay, yeah, so that's one way of thinking of it, right? So, of course, this is the lower schools would say that. The middle way consequence schools say, no, it's not. So middle way autonomous, mind only, they all say it's the consciousness. The Vaibhashikas, the Sautrantikas, all the other schools except the middle way consequence school would say no. And that is because they investigate consciousness itself for the person and you don't find such a person there. But persons are imputed to consciousness. You can't have a person without consciousness, but the person is not consciousness. So persons are imputed to them. Now, consciousnesses don't go and produce other consciousnesses that are independent of those consciousnesses.
So this really points out why mind at its potential is our first unit.
Yeah, this
the nature of what a person is.
A person is.
Yeah.
How things exist, you know.
So we kind of, you know, if Anne's kind of pointing out that it's quite challenging if one's been raised or educated within a Christian tradition, we kind of default back to, you know, who first created causes. Us.
Or, yeah, in the whole thing of science, they're going back looking for a first cause. And, you know, they got rid of the idea of God, but then the scientists themselves go, first cause. And what they usually do is looking out into the universe for it, don't they?
Yeah, so then even a materialist or a scientist would go back looking for a first cause.
That's right.
But it's not tenable from a scientific point of view.
No, that's right. It's not tenable from a scientific point of view. It's not tenable from a Buddhist point of view.
So then there is another question more to do with this slide about the recognizing, everyone as having been one's mother. Is that we're trying to see everyone as capable of loving as a mother?
Yep, well, that comes up in the next slide. That's point number two.
Okay.
But first of all, you could ask us, like, how do we know we have recognized all beings as having been our mother? So the measure of this is to have the same degree of recognition when you see something like a bug or some other small creature and to think, this creature was born as an insect this time. But when it was my mother and I was her son or daughter, I had to depend on her for everything. So when this recognition arises naturally to any being you encounter, then you've achieved this first stage. So when I read this, I was just thinking, you know, sometimes I'm in the shower and these little tiny cockroaches come out of the drains. Just standing in there, the little things start running around in there. You know, oftentimes you just want to flush them away, hey? Like, I don't like little insects. You know? Most of us don't like mosquitoes or cockroaches or anything like that. We don't have any sense of commonality or solidarity with them. we're just wiping out. So when we've actually got this being is recognizing your mother, it's like looking down there and going, oh, you know, not in this life, of course, because, you know, we've had a mother in this life who's just a human being. But in some other life, this being was my mother. And I was, you know, related to her as a son or a daughter in some way. So that's what we've got to do first of all. And then we recall their kindness. And we want to do that to inspire gratitude within us. So the person could be the mosquito, the cockroach, the human being. Their appeal increases in relation to our recognition of how kind they have been. We remember there are many ways of being kind to develop affection for them. So traditionally, the kindness of the mother has been discussed using sort of 4 points, and each of those points has is supported by 4 other points. So I'll just name the 4 points first of all, and then go through 1 or 2 of them using this technique. So the first thing to remember is the kindness of giving us this body. That's the first point. The second is the kindness of protecting us from this life's dangers. The third is the kindness of leading us in the path of the world. And the fourth is the kindness of bearing many hardships and accumulating negative karma for us. So we can start with taking the human mother of this lifetime, and then you can move it across to a bug or an animal or any other living being and go same thing, same way. Right? So we take the mother of this lifetime. So she was responsible, you know, our father and mother were responsible for us having the body that we have. So that we just acknowledge that the kindness of us having this body, of giving us this body. So all the pleasures you've experienced, all the physical good feelings that you've ever experienced through the body or your senses have come about through your mother's kindness, if you actually have a body. You look at that and you can say, not only that, the kindness of giving us this body, throughout countless times in previous lives, thinking that we can never repay that kindness that our mother has extended to us, which is giving us this body. And then see that all sentient beings have been kind in this way, whether they're our mother or, you know, at different times. So that's one, and we use those 4. So now I'll give you another one and show you the same again. So the second one, of course, was the kindness of protecting us from this life's dangers. That's the major heading, 4 points. Looking at the kindness of protecting us. So if you can remember back, or you watch another mother care for their child, you will see them protecting the child all the time from different types of dangers. But your mother did this, our mother did the same for us. Second point again, seeing she's been kind, seeing she has protected us from life's dangers countless times in previous lives. Third point, thinking that we can never repay the kindness of protecting us from life's dangers. And last, seeing that all sentient beings have protected us from life's dangers. I'll do a third one, but this is a nice one, the third one, I think. The third is the kindness of leading us in the path of the world. And that's it. So looking at the kindness, looking at that, acknowledging it, of leading us in the path of the world. So what do you think the path of the world, this term, means, anyone?
Oh, the first thing that comes to mind is, like, you know, how to not be bullied at school, or, you know, just how to be.
That's an example. That's right. It's just how to get on in the life you're in. What to do? How do you do it? How do you put on the jumper? How do you tie your laces on your shoes?
And so, Eddie,
how do you butter sandwiches?
When we're thinking about this, like, even if it wasn't our biological mother, I mean, the thing is too that mother is a function as well. So someone who acted as our mother would also be part of this, wouldn't they?
Yep, that's right. Yep. As in, we see this, seeing she's been kind countless times in previous lives. You know, no matter which life you're born into, with the how many times you've had a human mother, they will always try and protect you and help you, you know, be in the world. Thinking that you can't ever repay that type of kindness, and then seeing that all sentient beings have been kind in this way. So they always use these four points to support, you know, the major heading. And the last heading is, you know, the kindness of bearing many hardships and accumulating negative karma for us. The Lama's Lopa Rinpoche says, thinking like this, the meditation on the four ways our mother has been kind becomes incredibly powerful. So I took this, you know, I'd never come across this method before, and this was in the new book by Lama's Lopa Rinpoche on cultivation of bodhicitta. Now, there's another way of also thinking about recalling the kindness, and that is when you, this is like a special instruction. This instruction really comes out of the equalized exchange of self for others. But we can bring it in here as a way of recalling the kindness of all sentient beings and making it even more focused and immense. Right? And here's when you remember the kindness when they weren't our mother. So, like, you know, we go, okay, so I've got a mother in this lifetime, this is my mother, but I've got all these other beings here, and they're definitely not my mother in this lifetime. So how have they been kind to me? You know, then you'll find they've made the food you eat, the shoes you wear, the perfumes you put on yourself. It's just over and over and over, probably, you know, sewage and water and over, and then you find, oh my God. Now, one of the things that pops up for people in this meditation is that they think that the kindness that others extend to us has to be intentional. But it's only kind if they intend to be kind. And, you know, it's only kind if they're motivated by kindness. But that's the wrong way of looking at it.
Yeah, so Eddie, the thing that really impresses me about this is the kindness of basically, like, civilization, that we have, fair work practices. We have a social safety net. We have, you know, yeah, road rules and, you know, all of these things to make a safe society. And that's really relatively new, and through the huge efforts of so many people that we don't even know.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so when you, I guess, you know, this will sort of become really obvious to you once you start investigating this, and it could easily bring tears to your eyes that so many people have done so much, and we reap the benefits of that. So, like I said, the point of doing this is to become grateful. Now, once you're grateful about this, then is this thing, okay, so what do you do when you're grateful to someone else? Resolve to repay their kindness. So here I've got a picture of Janis Joplin with her bottle of What was the drink she used?
Bourbon, Jim Beam.
Sorry? Jim Beam Bourbon. Jim Beam Bourbon. That's right. That's what you used to drink, right? And anybody who's read about her life will know how much she suffered and ended up dead at a very young age. And just yesterday, I read a book about this man and his relationship with his mother. And he was saying, like, his mother was sort of a different type of person, but she died when she was 50 through alcoholism. But she was married three times in her life. Alcohol destroyed the second and third marriages. And yet this fellow, like, he knew, he was grateful to the kindness that his mother had extended to him, how she brought him up, the different things she did. And what he really wanted to do, and he wasn't able to, was to repay her kindness by showing her what he'd achieved in his life. But he wasn't able to because she passed away before he achieved those goals. So the idea here is to inspire within us a reciprocity of affection. So in other words, you're saying, wow, these people were so kind to us in the past. I want to be kind back to them. I want to repay their kindness with kindness. So to realize that all beings have been our mothers, and to remember that they've been extremely kind is not enough. They're just the two steps. When you go up and get strong, of course, your parents' health wanes and their abilities decrease. And this is only natural. Therefore, it's very important to think, now that I've grown older, now that I've finished school, I've got all these skills, I've got some wisdom, I've got some knowledge. For us, we've entered a Buddhist path. We've found a philosophy that works. We're trying to put it into practice. We have some confidence in it. And our parents have no idea about it. So we're going to, I've got to serve my parents. I've got to help them in return. So the specific point really is that all of our mothers are in samsara and have been experiencing samsara's suffering from beginningless time. And so what can we do for them? How can we repay their kindness knowing that that's what's going on for them? Knowing, like Jaina said, has to find solace in a bottle of bourbon or, a shot of heroin. That was her way of decreasing her suffering. So there's a verse from Chandra Goman, a great meditator and scholar, who said, in the ocean of samsara in which we find ourselves, all having fallen foul of the current, if one were to desert those whom one has known through life and death and alone gain liberation, there could be nothing so shameful. So the verse suggests, if you fail to develop a benevolent attitude, both directly and indirectly toward all sentient beings, whatever practices you do will not constitute the Mahayana Dharma. So let's do a brief meditation, only take a minute or so. So just adjust your posture, drop your shoulders, straighten your back, and think about the helplessness of all limited beings. Beings who find themselves with bodies and minds which are limited, and this limitation is called samsara. Think about the helplessness of those people, those beings. Then remind yourself that you are a bit better off in the sense that you have some familiarity with a path that leads to freedom. And think about and accept the fact that they rely upon you. And decide to free them from their states of helplessness. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about this term, love, from the Buddhist perspective. So love, so this is from a text called The Path of Purification. Path of Purification. So love has the aspect of friendliness as its characteristic. Love has the aspect of friendliness as its characteristic. Its function is to promote friendliness. It is manifested as the disappearance of malice and annoyance. Its proximate cause is seeing others as lovable. When it succeeds, it eliminates malice. When it fails, it degenerates into selfish, affectionate desire. So love views one, many, or all beings as lovable and wishes them well. In terms of our development of it, we may begin with one or just a few people. By gradually increasing our ability to love, we will be able to extend love to more and more living beings until it spreads to all beings without exception. It will spread to those who treat us well and those who disparage or harm us. Those who have good values and those who do not, to those we approve of and those we don't, to those who are well liked by all and those who are despised. Now, this love does not seek anything for ourselves. The pleasure is in the loving. But as Holiness says, such love is strong, not fickle, according to either our mood or how others treat us. It is ready to help, but does not have an agenda or coerce others to fulfill our expectations. So when I read this and wrote this up, you know, it's just, you realize, man, you're a long, long way from the Buddhist conception of love. At least I am. Then as Holiness goes on to say, and this is in Praise of Great Compassion on page 6, combining the understanding of selflessness with love demolishes any sense of possession. Love infused with a sense of selflessness knows that ultimately there is no possessor or person to possess. There is no independent soul or essence in a person to love or to be loved. The highest love wishes beings to have the highest happiness and will show others the path to the end of suffering, the path realized and taught by the Buddha.
So, Eddie, that selflessness, that's that particular meaning of selflessness, the philosophical one, not the...
Yeah, relate to emptiness.
Yeah, it's not a common idea of like altruism or something.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that's a good thing to point out, honey.
So can you just read that first sentence again?
Of which part?
The
selflessness?
Yeah.
Okay. Combining the understanding of selflessness with love demolishes any sense of possession.
Yeah, that's dynamite.
So love infused with a sense of selflessness knows that ultimately there is no possessor or person to possess. Now this is a fantastic thing. Like I said, it's possible to get this idea that the person is not the body, not the mind, not the collection of them. They're not inside it, and they're not outside it. And I think you can get that. Then when you look at another person and you desire them, That's what you should remember, right? Especially if you're in a relationship. When you say to yourself, oh, wow, they're so beautiful, or you get these feelings and you wish to possess them because you think you love them, then ask yourself, but where's that person you love? It's not the body, it's not the mind, it's not the collection, it's not in there. And yet, I'm sure when you say this, if you love them, that's what you're getting at. So that person ain't there. Then the thing is that you've got this thing called love. Then you have a look at that, like where is that? Go through your whole body and mind. You won't find it. And so this is a terrific way of stopping selfish affectionate desire. And you're becoming, what's the love? The wish that they be happy. And you are going to help them be happy by not engaging with them as if they were an object to be possessed. You can engage with friendliness, knowing that they want to be happy, just as we do. And we see the equality of self and other. And you go, just as I work for myself to be happy, I should work for you to be happy. Just as I know you don't want suffering, and neither do I won't hurt you. As I do my best not to hurt myself. So anyway, it's very easy to talk about these things, but I know from my own experience it's not very easy to do it. We need to actually begin at the beginning. Because like I say, this type of love here is not the love that we're familiar with. I think the love we're familiar with is, like I said, this romantic love. Which really has a sense of selfishness attached to it. Anyway, if we've got equanimity in place and we're promoting friendliness on that basis, right, we end up with what's called impartial love. And here we have this verse that most of us are familiar with. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and its causes. So here, and this next verse too, they've got this thing of, this is the affectionate love, affection for them. Now the next ones, these you can see there's elements of what's it called, affectionate love, the cherishing love. May they have these. And I shall cause them to have these. This is really the cherishing. And inspire me to go with this is this wishing. So, like I said, when we have this affectionate love has arisen because we understand like how kind they have been to us. The cherishing, we want to repay this kindness. The wishing is that we know what they need to be happy. Yeah? So we wish to do that. So first we have this, this wish that sentient beings have happiness and its causes. The phrase "and its causes" is explicitly added when generating love and compassion, indicating a wish that sentient beings understand the law of karma and its effects and the path to awakening, so that they will create causes for happiness and stop creating causes for suffering. And this verse, when you look at this verse, it's sort of it's got all of these three forms of love in here: affectionate, cherishing, and wishing. So, I bumped my little mouse. You know, remember that first verse in 8th verse of the thought transformation, with the intention to attain the ultimate and supreme goal that surpasses even a wish granting gem. May I constantly cherish all living beings. So we cherish them with the with understanding how affectionate they have been to us, all the goodness that they have provided to us, but also understanding that if we can generate, if we can reciprocate with love and kindness, we can actually become a Buddha. That's the potential that we have when we repay the kindness of others with our affection. So it's not just what they've done, it's understanding the potential that can arise through us acknowledging their kindness and repaying it. But now we come to the final, loving kindness. And so this is to inspire like a recognition of the value of others being happy. So here we've got this term loving kindness, and it's sort of the fourth step in the sevenfold instruction. And it's really loving kindness here is seeing beings as very, very dear to us. And this loving kindness is distinguished from the general meaning of it, where we just wish beings to be happy. So there, you know, when you wish beings to be happy, we just say, well, you know, may you be happy, may you have the causes of happiness. This loving kindness is distinguished by the idea that we know that recognizing their kindness, wishing to repay it, and repaying it can bring about enlightenment. So when we meditate on this, so we've got to sort of recollect that beings are controlled by karma and affliction. We think that they, and we have to do this repeatedly, that they lack ordinary and authentic happiness. So you know, most beings try to be happy using the senses. They try to grab the objects of the senses, draw them in, possess them, and to be happy. That's what we normally do, and it doesn't work. The way to be authentically happy is to sort of use the mind itself, to cultivate the mind, rather than taking this hunter-gatherer approach of like grabbing and pulling it into us. And so we know that we have to authentic happiness will come about by cultivating its causes. And what are its causes? Recognizing the kindness of others, wishing to repay that kindness, and repaying that kindness through helping them find an authentic happiness. Now, Arya Kamala Shila said this, you know, so moistened by love, the mind becomes like friable, fertile soil. When you plant the seed of compassion, it grows easily and bountifully. Therefore, after you infuse your mind with love, cultivate compassion. And this is the way they do it in the six causes of one effect method. And how can we begin to do this? Start with yourself. You contemplate often, may I be happy and free from suffering. May I be free from animosity, afflictions, and anxiety, and live happily. And whatever other good wishes you have for yourself, like may I be generous and kind. Or, may I be free from internal and external obstacles. So focusing on yourself first is really important to develop the feeling of what it's like to wish someone well. In the process of doing this, you realize that being happy and peaceful and avoiding pain are everyone's fundamental wishes. Now, as Holiness says, that, you know, some people may wonder if generating love towards themselves is selfish or self-indulgent. But he says that cultivating love towards yourself is not selfish, because the goal is to generate love towards all beings, which includes yourself. You are no more or less important than others. You're also worthy of love and kindness. And he says, you know, since many people suffer from self-hatred, this meditation is an excellent counteracting method. So I put up a slide which just has the meditation I mentioned in brief. So if we were to do the complete meditation, we start with this one for ourselves. Then we would contemplate in the same way, wishing the same good circumstances for someone you respect. So this person would often be your guru, your teacher, someone who's really close to you and perhaps even being on the same path as you. So you respect this person. Because the next one is you wish to do the same thing again, but this time for a friend. Yeah, so wishing for the friend. May you be happy and free from suffering. May you be free from animosity, anxiety, and live happily. May you be free from internal and external obstacles on the path. And you sort of have to do this sort of slowly, so you can feel a change in your attitude for yourself and for the other. Now, after you've done someone you respect, someone that you like as a friend, then find somebody neutral, like a stranger or somebody at the store. Then you go finally to find somebody you're normally hostile towards. So you imagine that person being happy, and because of that, their actions and speech change. So when you've done that, you know, just sort of like rest your mind in the feeling of wishing everyone happiness and imagining them to be happy. So this is the way you can actually do it when you sit down on your cushion at home. But when you're out and about in the city or anywhere else, whenever you see somebody, remind yourself that that person wants to be happy and wishes to avoid suffering. So then wish them, and may they be free and happy. Now use any of these phrases that you've used on your meditation cushion, bring them out into the world. So like a suitable time in your session, but when you're outside anywhere, that's the suitable time. Quiet place at home, busy place in the city. Try and do it with a relaxed mindset. So use a good motivation for doing this. You know, understand it, you know, why you're doing this. Pose lethargy and sleepiness. Be careful about what you eat when you're at home. And also, of course, when you're out and about, you can get quite speedy. So you need to sort of just slow down and pay attention to other people. Especially just look at their faces in the city. Look at their body language. Well, you don't see many people smiling in the city. It's very obvious to me that most people are suffering to some degree. You know? So, you know, challenge yourself. When you find the people that you're looking at that you don't like the way they look, or they're dressed, or what they're doing, and you have a natural sort of aversion to them, then challenge yourself and remind yourself, oh, that person wants to be happy, that person's actually not. And may they be happy, may they be free from suffering. So of course, and then always dedicate what you are doing towards becoming enlightened.
Eddie, just before you start, there is one more question someone's brought up about how they're Their default view of being kind is tending to see others as their children. So what's the significance, the difference between, instead of seeing all sentient being as being, say, a child that we're responsible for, that we see them as our mother or someone that's cared for us?
The big difference is when you look at your child, what's your child done to protect you from suffering? What's your child done for you while you were pregnant? Now, there's a whole lot of things that your child will not have done for you. And you could go back to other meditation, looking at all the things your mother has done for you, and then put it up against your child and ask yourself, was my child done that? That's the big difference.
And the psychological point of that difference, that different type of focus is
well, major difference in terms of gratitude for the gratitude for you, for the person who's given you birth and looked after you, is immense compared to the gratitude of the child.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the major thing. It's like they seem to have the gratitude. Yeah. Now I should also say there's a in the Pali tradition, they often focus on the child and not the mother. No, but whatever it is, you've got to be able to go, you've got to be really grateful this person is here. And what have they done? How have they protected you? What you always find when you look at your child as Mandy, I think there are feelings of gratitude, but they're about you. You know, it's not sort of focusing on the obs of what have they done.
Yep, that's clear
you
now.
Like I'm grateful to have you can say I'm grateful to have the child. But yeah, in terms of what they've done for you, it's really limited. And besides, I should also say though, it's not just mothers we go through here, it's like you use mothers for starters, because for the Tibetan tradition or Asian tradition, this is the most obvious person. But if you know, it might be your father, so you can start with your father. The idea is to start with someone that you actually put a great deal of gratitude towards, you wish to repay their gratitude, and you will. Recognizing it, wanting to repay it, then repaying it. So you could start with your father, all sorts of different things. But it's in the end, you'll have to go through all of them. So it's not just like once, you know. It's not just mothers. It's mother, father, brother, sister, all sorts of things like that. So what we need to do to try and put this into practice is actually study first, right? Don't just leap into it. Like perhaps get a few books, read widely, really think about it, and then try and put it into practice. Now, if you find that it's very, very difficult to get your head around all sentient beings have been our mothers, and then, you know, when they were our mothers, they were incredibly kind to us. There are other techniques to develop loving kindness. There is also the practice of in rhythm, equalizing exchanging, and the book also shows other ways of developing it. So don't give up. This method doesn't suit me. There are others you can use. Now, in the future, so up on YouTube, they've got the DVD called How to Meditate from the Discovering Buddhism series. There are a number of meditations in the PDFs that we put up online in the members area. So have a look at those and complete them. And also there's some review questions. So if you could complete those, if you wish to. So one of the students sent to me yesterday, in fact, the complete review questions already answered, and she did a really good job of them too. So if you'd like to do that, Please do, and I'll go through each one and answer them for you.
And also, what's not on that slide, Eddie, is that we have one more class, which
is
the question and answer class coming up. So, a lot more informal, where you get to ask all the questions, the big picture kind of view of this whole course.
Yeah, and as a sort of a framework for that, I'll take those review. I'll use the review questions as our framework to go through. So you will go through them again. But in the meantime, if you have your own questions, please bring them along and let's have a look at them. So are there any final questions from anybody else?
No, that's pretty much all of them.
Okie dokie. So let's dedicate the merit thing. So thank you for being here, everybody, and going to be in the class. So let's dedicate the spirit, which does not exist on its own side, but does exist in mere name. Along with the merit of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and all sentient beings who don't exist from their side of the basis, but do exist in mere name. May we become enlightened to bring about full awakening for all those sentient beings and for ourselves. So through the spirit, may we quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all beings, without exception, to that enlightened state. And may the mind of loving kindness and the supreme dual mind of bodhicitta that have not arisen, may they arise and grow. And if they have arisen, may they never diminish, but always increase. And bring us ever closer to enlightenment. Thank you, everyone.